WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Blues singers, tap dancers, comics toured the country on what was called the TOBA circuit. Now, officially, that stood for the Theater Owners Booking Association, but amongst the performers, T-O-B-A stood for Tough on Black Asses. In New Orleans, the theater for black actors was the Lyric Theater, which became the stage for great performers like Bill Bojangles Robinson, Ethel Waters, Bessie Smith, Butterbeans and Susie. It's here in the Lyric Theater that the musical One More Time is set. Now playing at the Schubert Theater in Philadelphia, One More Time is billed as the new 1920s vaudeville musical. It features the fictitious Bertha Williams Touring Company performing a mix of blues and comedy in 1926. The band is featured on center stage, spotlighting Jabbo Smith, a trumpeter who's now in his 70s, and when he was in his 20s, he was considered to be one of Armstrong's greatest competitors. Playing the role of the singer and dancer, Papa Du, is Vernel Benares, who is also the creator and director of One More Time. Those of you who saw the film Pretty Baby might have also remembered his performance in that. Vernel Benares is my guest. Before we meet him and talk about One More Time and about the music of New Orleans, where he is from, let's listen to a selection from the original cast recording. Now, this was made at the Village Gate in New York, and this was done before the present production. So basically, the album has a different cast than the cast now. But this is Vernel Benares and the original cast singing Cakewalkin' Babies.
Cakewalkers may come, cakewalkers may go, but I want to tell y'all about this couple I know. They high-stepping gals and debonair. When it comes to business, not a soul can compare.
Here they come.
Well, here they come.
Look at them demonstrate, going some.
They going some.
Look at them sink a big chunk of the town. He's in a round, picking them up and laying them down. Dancing fools.
They dancing fools.
Stretch your stuff.
I struck the stuff.
They don't do nothing different.
The cakewalking babies from home. Try, but you never beat them.
Stretch your stuff.
Oh, stretch your stuff.
They don't do nothing different.
The cakewalking babies from home.
Okay, that's Cakewalkin' Babies from Home from the soundtrack, from the cast recording, I should say, of the musical One More Time, which is now playing at the Schubert. And my guest is Vernel Benares, who is one of the stars of the show. He's the person who conceived it and who directed it. Welcome to Fresh Air. I really enjoyed your performance.
Great, thank you very much.
How did you get interested in the period of New Orleans in the 1920s, which is where the show is set?
I think the original seed came from my grandmother, who used to tell me stories when I would stay at home with her, when she'd mind me for my parents to go play bingo or something. She would mind me and tell me stories about the Lyric and what they would do and who would be there. She knew a lot of the performers and people that worked there.
How did you start listening to the music? Did you dig up old records?
Yeah. At first, it was a thing that my parents didn't go for at all, because it's to their generation, it's a music with a stigma to it. And they didn't want me to get involved in the blues and second line and an A-Nana of New Orleans music. But I did it anyway. I went to the library and listened in the jazz archives and found myself in Preservation Hall night after night and just gradually got to know the music very well.
That's an interesting thing, that it was a stigma to your parents and a loved period for your grandparents.
Exactly.
Can you discuss the stigma a little bit, the problems that they
sure.
had with it?
In New Orleans, there's this music is usually connected with either parties, rent parties in the sense of low-down parties and fun times, or with funerals and weddings where people get a little wild. My parents grew up with the fact that the New Orleans music of that period, of the 20s and 30s, was a music that if you had a nice party with nice people, and we use that in the show, the nice people thing, then you'd play records that were, you know, Ray Charles and Nat King Cole and nice, Frank Sinatra, that kind of thing, and stay away from that old rowdy New Orleans music, which Dr. Rawlins in the 20s once claimed that jazz was an intoxicant and would drive people into wild spirits. That, in a way, is very true to me now, and I see what my parents were fighting against, that if the music that was really in their blood, in their souls, did come out at a party and they'd had a few drinks, they would lose this stiffness and this sophistication that they had worked hard to get, being black, and to stay away from, and they would just drop it and start dancing in the second line or typical dances of New Orleans, which was for lower class people.
How did you relate to your parents' distaste for this music? Were you able to accept that and then just listen to it on your own, or did you resent their feelings towards the music?
In the beginning, I resented their feelings towards it, and I played it louder. Later, I found that I was able to enjoy myself better by just losing myself into my own world, which meant going to the library, putting headphones on, and loving it.
You're 30 now, right?
Yeah.
What about your friends, your peers? How did they react to you listening to Bessie Smith and Jelly Roll Morton and everyone else who you were listening to?
They think it's sort of weird. And then when they realize what's being said... See, I have to back up a little bit. The records are on race labels, all of those records. They were produced for black audiences, so they were technically very, very poor. It's hard to hear not only musicality, but the very words to the song. Once you've heard the song maybe 10 times, you start to understand what is a theme that the singer is talking about, and suddenly a whole new world opens up. You have black poetry sitting in front of you. Once my friends got to understand and hear, I'd type out sheets for them to know what the words were, then they thought it was extremely clever and very well written and something to look up to. But before that, it was scratches and what is that weird sound.
What are some of the lyrics that impressed you the most?
Something like, you got the right key, but you're working on the wrong keyhole. I couldn't get along with you to save my soul. That's one song. The other one was, I got what it takes, and it breaks my heart to give it away. Stingy men, they crying for it every day. And just some, just cleverly, not the rhyme part of it so much, but I was in English literature when I was in college. And, it's not the rhyme as much as it is the thought of black people at that time really putting across heavy philosophies, but very simply, with a very simple background music to it.
When did you decide to do One More Time?
I was on tour with a classical group, the Everyman Players, and I was on a bus and truck sort of thing, in the southeast. And I had my earphones, and I was listening to my own music privately because I didn't like what was on the radio, particularly the disco. And after a few days, certain friends that I had made on the bus, other actors, would borrow my earphones. And after a couple of weeks, they'd turn the radio off, and rather than have an earphone at all, I'd unplug the earphone and just leave it play. And I started realizing that it was infectious, and that people were interested if they knew what was being said. And I thought, if I could put on stage glass clear this black poetry, plus the special sound of this music of New Orleans, it could be a dynamic evening. But I was very against the musical review aspect, so I didn't do it right away. I didn't do it until I went back to New Orleans and frustrated myself a while trying to figure out exactly what it was I wanted to do, and spoke to my grandmother again, met some friends of hers, interviewed her, and realized that I could make a play about the Lyric Theater and not a musical review, which I was really not very interested in at the time, the Bubbling Brown Sugar, UB sort of musical review, because I'm basically not a singer. I'm an actor, and most of the people drawn into One More Time are basically actresses and actors.
Is that the objection you had to musical reviews, or do you not like the form either?
I don't like the form particularly. I think, you know, that I go to concerts if I want to hear an evening of music. And if I go to the theater, I expect not only a storyline, but some sort of theme and some reason why I was there. I want to learn in some sort of way. So I put together One More Time, actually, as a black theater history piece to two colleges. New York producers saw it and got very excited and thought that it could work in a regular commercial theater. That was fine with me as well, but we never changed for the commercial theater. It's still like it would be if it were touring originally black colleges and then on to all colleges as a piece of black theater history.
Describe what you've done for us. Describe the setting and the story and how that works in with the music.
Well, it's an evening at the Lyric Theater in 26 because it burned down in 1927. That was going to be my subtitle. But Bertha Williams and her touring company have arrived, and there's problems. They were low paid, and there wasn't black hotels, so you never knew if you had a room to sleep in or not. And they've arrived, and one of the women was trying to subsidize her pay, which was low anyway, by hustling, and she got arrested on the train and turned over to the police. And so they won short. And Bertha sends off one of the company, Aggie, to get her out of jail with the $100 that they have, which was a lot of money at that time. And he decided he'd make more leaving town and never seen Bertha in a touring company again than he would in a few weeks of working every night. So he left. So they're too short when the play opens. And the theater owner uses that to not pay the group because the contract says that they should have six performers, and they don't. They only have four. So he waits until the show is practically over to tell him, well, you're not going to get paid. And they figure out a way out because it is a comedy and it is a happy ending. In all of this, by the way, I didn't do a drama on purpose. I don't wear a red, black, and green hat. And I'm just more of a person that need a sense of humor about things, and even looking back, you get the point that they were treated poorly and there was bad pay and everything else, but still you're entertained and you enjoy it, and you get the point through pleasure, not through preaching.
There's a temptation, I think, when you're doing a piece that's set decades or hundreds of years ago and you're recognizing the oppression of the people within that period, there's a temptation to put political words of today into the mouths
exactly.
of these characters of yesterday.
Exactly. And the thing about these characters that I got through my interviews were that though they were ill-treated and though they went to other towns that they may have not had hotels, they still were not left with the normal jobs that 90% of blacks had at that time, which was very menial labor in factories, cigar-making factories. My own grandmother worked in a cigar-making factory, and or they were maids, or whatever. They were still dressed in costumes, going from town to town, making money off of their talent. And so they were happy people, and it's a happy time, and I didn't want to depress it with heavy philosophical things that I have in my heart about it.
I'd like to take a pause here from our conversation and return to the cast recording for a moment.
Great.
Listen to you again. This is the New Orleans Hopscotch Blues.
Oh.
And we're going to hear my guest, Vernell Benares, performing this. And again, he's the creator, director, and one of the stars of One More Time, which is now at the Schubert Theater. And the cast recording was recorded, I guess, about a year ago or so at the Village Gate in New York when it was being performed there. Before we hear this, why don't you tell us why you chose to include this song in the show?
Well, the story I just gave was the backstage side of it. Now what you're going to hear is the onstage side of the Lyric Theater. And the New Orleans Hopscotch Blues, the music halls like the Lyric Theater were used to introduce new dancers all the time. The performers would actually teach it to an audience, and the audience from then on went out and did their steps. So this is a dance, it's the Hopscotch Blues, and Papa Doo actually teaches it while he's performing it.
Right, we're going to miss the nice dancing in this, but let's hear it.
Oh, New Orleans is a great big old southern town where hospitality, it can sure be found. The population there, they're very, very fair, and Lord, the things they do, white folks y'all do it too. They got a dance and it sure is something rare there. Glide, slide, prance, oh, dance, and then you hop, stop, take it easy, baby, yeah, I say, yeah. Well, I never get tired dancing my hopscotch blues. Once more, you got to glide, you slide, you prance, oh, dance. That hopscotch blues will make you do a lovely shake and make you feel so grand when you walk hand in hand. You never get tired dancing my hopscotch blues. Lay it down.
My guest Vernell Benares singing the New Orleans Hopscotch Blues as recorded on the cast album of One More Time. You never formally studied this period when you were a student. What did you do to get a sense of how you should walk and dance and sing when you were on stage?
Well, as an actor, I mean, personally, I had several... I told you I'd interviewed a lot of people. But they would show me their number, and and you just integrate all of that as an actor. You get character references, they call it. And for myself, I had three guys. One is an uncle of mine, my Uncle Peanut, who showed me a lot of his stuff, and I just incorporated it. And as a director, I had everybody in the cast to go out and get character references. I would give them names of people, and they would visit with them and make friends with them and really try to understand where people were at the Lyric then.
One of the things that really impressed me about your performance is that I found your singing and your dancing really fluid and very behind the beat. And it's been my experience as a listener that when some people now return to the period of the 1920s, it's very loud and brash and hurried, and maybe too much on the beat or even ahead of the beat, but it doesn't feel or sound right to me.
Well, our job really was to put together something that was black vaudeville as opposed to white roaring 20s style. And plus, one thing I kept telling the actresses was, it's New Orleans, it's 98 degrees, there's no air conditioning in that place, you're not going to be flapping all over the place, it's the South. So the dialogue-wise, as well as the dance and on-stage performance, nobody was pushing. It was a family orientation as opposed to a show business sort of thing.
What do you think are some of the things people do wrong when they're trying to perform music or dances of that period?
I think they try. One comment that really flips me is, go out and sell it. They always say, you know, when you're in a musical or some type. I think if you go out and enjoy it yourself, I mean, really enjoy it, people, it will be infectious that they will enjoy it as well. But to go out and have a smile plastered on your face and go against every natural emotion that you have within you to perform, that's not what performing is about to me. So that a lot of times, by the way, the show changes. We have a very big comeback business. I don't know exactly to call it, but people come back one more time, you know, to see it. Part of that is because the songs vary. For example, the Hopscotch Blues we just listened to, I was rather up that night, I noticed. I was almost laughing in my voice and showing them how to do the steps. Sometimes I go out and I'm not, it's a little more slippery, slimy sort of approach to it. It changes, and rather than fighting the nightly change, incorporate it.
The musical is set in the Lyric Theater, and this was a theater for black audiences. Mm-hmm. There was a different theater in New Orleans for white audiences.
Yeah.
Was this a legal thing? Was it actually illegal to mix together?
Yeah, the blacks and whites were not allowed under the same roof at all. So that they couldn't, no matter what the economic or intellectual level that you had as a black person, you had to go to the Lyric. You couldn't go to the French Opera House or to the Symphony or any of the other vaudeville houses. You had to, so that it was actually a responsibility of very creative owners, creative in the primitive sense, to put on a show that would please everybody. They had opera singers, classical dancers, blackface comedians, comedy teams, blues singers, and what you did was hold on to your ticket and wait until your style came on. And if you couldn't take opera, if you were, all the different levels were right next to each other. There was a PhD sitting next to a plumber, sitting next to a nurse, and, you know, whatever. You just had to deal with it because of your color, your skin, that was the place that you had to be, no matter what your specific choices were.
Was there a specific order in which the acts were billed?
They usually saved the company, which is the only thing that I present. I didn't think that a modern audience, even though it may be very authentic, which was always our thing to keep it authentic, but even though it may be authentic, we had to stop somewhere. I didn't think that a modern audience could really take a juggler and an opera singer, one behind the other sort of thing. So we instead went with Bertha Williams and a touring company, which they would always say for the last half, everybody liked whatever big touring company they came, because they had their own variances within the company. And they'd save that for the second half of the show.
And the touring company did mostly blues songs?
No, they did up-tempo. They taught new dances that they had just gotten out of Atlanta or Birmingham or someplace. You know, they had a new experience for New Orleans people because they traveled around. So they picked up all this stuff. They were the people that traveled around and related what was going on with other blacks all over the country.
Now, although black and white audiences couldn't mingle in the same theater, blacks could perform for white audiences.
Well, they did mingle once. They mingled every Saturday midnight. The Lyric Theater was in the red light district. And you can imagine Saturday midnight, no one cared much about the law at that time in the red light district. So Saturday midnights, they had an open white and black audience. The whites sat in the balcony and the blacks were downstairs.
But now, black acts could perform for white audiences.
Yeah, they did.
Did they perform different acts for white audiences?
Yeah, I think they cooled their number a little bit. Bessie Smith performed for white audiences quite a bit, you know. But in those cases, what they would do is the more popular stuff, whatever, what was put out as a race label, but some kind of way snuck into RCA or whatever as a big distribution, they would do that stuff. And they would save their saucier material for an all-black audience.
There's one number, and we'll be hearing that number as done on the cast recording, that you do as a comedian, where you put on blackface.
Right, yeah.
Why were black performers putting on blackface during this period?
Well, it came from... there was also a law that blacks had to wear blackface in order to appear on the stage. That was in the early 1900s. That law was abolished, and blacks didn't have to anymore. But what they did was make fun of the time when they had to, and also they made fun of all the white performers who were now putting on blackface and trying to be black in films and on stage. If there was a Lillian Hellman play, I don't know if she wrote then, she's probably too young, but if there was a Southern play where you had a butler and a maid and an all-white cast, then two of the white cast members would be black. They'd put on blackface and be the butler and the maid. Blacks were commenting in their own vaudeville houses comically on how whites saw them as blacks. And they were also, like I said, historically commenting on a time when they had to. So it was a big joke.
Why, at the time, earlier in the 20th century, mm-hmm. was there a law requiring blacks to wear blackface when they were performing? I don't understand that.
Well, for example, on the streets of New Orleans, the women had to wear scarves on their heads to show that they were black. Women with black blood were not allowed on the streets without a scarf. That's when you see all those movies with the praline sellers and stuff. They have scarves on their head. The black race has always been so varied that a lot of blacks don't particularly have the physicalities that immediately point them to being black. It may point them to being Cuban or French or whatever. So they wanted to know that blacks were black. And the only way to certainly tell was to make laws like women have to wear scarves on the street. Men, if they're on stage, you have to have on a black face. Bert Williams was very light-skinned, for example, with gray eyes. So if he came out and did his same routine, there may be mistakes. They wanted no mistakes at that time.
You were telling us a little before that this period of the 1920s, your parents felt very alienated from. I wonder how they and how other people you know reacted to your number in blackface.
Thank God. It's been well received. Even my parents thought it was hilarious because it's a clown. And what we did to assure that is a ridiculous costume and using bushy hair like a clown would have, and a lot of mime movement to make it into a definite clown act and nothing else.
Okay, we're going to hear this number from the cast recording. Do you want to set the scene for us anymore?
Well, yeah, I guess. Papa Doo has... Aggie has gone, and Papa and Edna as well, the exotic dancer, she's gone. But he's figured out that the contract didn't say six performers. He's the slicko of the group, by the way, and the brains. He's figured out it didn't say six performers, but rather four singers, an exotic dancer, and a blackface comedian. So if he did the blackface, and one of the women did the exotic dance, then they would legally have their contract set up, and they would get paid. So he goes out to do Aggie's routine, blackface.
And this is the number.
Now up in New York City, folks thought it was a pity that the landlord had to raise that rent so high. We hustled around that town, and all our hustling round, we could not raise that rent, no way we tried. Well, my mama took in washing, my sister done the ironing, I helped around the town by shining shoes. But my daddy walked around like he owned New York town, spending all mama's money on moonshine booze. He's in the jailhouse now. He's in the jailhouse now. And if he ever gets that rent, call on distance to repent. He's in the jailhouse now. Now I went out last Friday, I met a big fat girl named Ida, who thought I was the swellest coon in town. She commenced to call me honey, naturally I began to spend my money. We took in every cabaret could be found. We was drinking every minute, I thought that I was in it. I was buying tomato rum by the pound. But when I went to pay that man, I found old Ida's hand right in my pocket where my money was. She's in the graveyard now. She's in the graveyard now. I told that judge right to his face, Ida's hand was out of place. She's in the graveyard now.
Okay, that was my guest Vernal Benares, and that in the show One More Time is done in blackface, and the show is now being performed in Philadelphia at the Schubert Theater. The Lyric Theater burnt down in 1927, a year after your show is set. Was there ever a replacement for it? What happened after it?
Nothing. It's a parking lot today, and the only thing left is some broken up tiles on the ground in the parking lot, normally with a car parked over it, which says Lyric. That's it.
You were telling us before that initially you were putting this together as a pretty educational program that was going to tour colleges and mm-hmm. would be a way to learn about the period and have a really enjoyable evening, and then some producers picked up on it. What was that process like when you were trying to work it up into something for a paying club or theater audience?
Well, it was very difficult because everyone has their own opinions as to what will work, and we had a definite feeling as to what we were doing, being very authentic and portraying the emotion and the mood of a period. But there were people like, well, take the blackface out, take some of those lines out that say things that shouldn't be said in today's audiences. Take the book out at one point. All of this take out, put in, take out. All the way to Joe, I went to see some people at Joe Papp's, and they thought, yeah, we can do it, but you have to do this too and do that. I was prepared to stay in New Orleans and, through a booking agent, go to colleges like I had originally planned. And then the DeLugoffs saw it and said, leave it exactly like it is. Don't mess with the costumes, the set, nothing. And I said, fine. And up to New York we went. Exactly like it was in New Orleans.
How did the album develop from that?
Jerry Wexler, who is vice president, I think, with Warner Brothers, he's a big fan of Butterbeans and Susie Bessie Smith. He produces Bob Dylan, Aretha Franklin, all those people, the popular music. But whenever he goes off privately, vacation, and he's got tapes of Jelly Roll Morton and Bessie Smith, that kind of thing. So he was immediately interested in the show. He came down doing rehearsals and decided to also produce the show, which raised us from the level of posters here and there to television commercials that would really get people in to see it. And of course, his connection with Warner Brothers, we had an album immediately.
Now you're in Philadelphia, and I imagine you'll be touring to other parts of the country afterwards.
Probably, yes.
Has the show changed at all, or are you still able to do what you were doing then?
I'm able to do what I'm doing. The set's a lot bigger, but I wanted that. All the things that are different are things that economically I couldn't handle before. For example, we stylized the set that this is the feeling of what a backdrop at the lyric would have given you. Now, a great set designer named Carl Exte, he's duplicated the inside of the lyric from all the pictures that I gave him of what the outside looked like, because there were no pictures of the inside. But he's actually duplicated the lyric theater. And that's a lot better to me than a stylized little band set, that kind of thing, where there were general improvements that just financially couldn't be handled before we got to a national touring company level.
One of the people who is in the cast, in the band, but also sings a couple of numbers, is the trumpeter Jabbo Smith, who was very popular in the 1920s, in which he recorded a number of records. How did you find him and invite him to be
in the
production?
Well, Jabbo found me, which is weird. He came down. He had been retired for about 30 years. He was an Avis, rent-a-car, whatever you call it, man in Milwaukee for about 30 years, and His wife, who was the only person in his life, got to a point where she didn't recognize him, and he had really nothing left but his trumpet. So he ventured down to New Orleans to see what was happening, as he puts it. And there was this little man in the front row three times when I'd go out who was yelling at us and having a great time and coming backstage each time saying, "You got it. That's the way it was, and that's the truth." They're just going on about it. And finally, I said, "Who is Jabbo Smith?" And because the music directors assumed I knew who he was, which I didn't. And they gave me his albums and some literature on him. And I found out he was in Shuffle Alone in 1926. And just, he fascinates me every day in his in his belief in life and going on, and if this doesn't work, then you do it that way, because that's the way it is. You know, he's just a total optimist. And finally, I asked him if he'd be interested in being in the show, and he said yes, you know, and jumped right in. And the two songs that he performs in the show, Love and Yes, Yes, are both songs that he wrote for the show.
Well, since I played those earlier in the week, I thought what we could do now is listen to something that he recorded in 1929, and this is something called Till Times Get Better. And
that's
we'll be
Jabbo's
hearing him
philosophy.
We'll be hearing him on trumpet and vocals. Now, you're familiar with this record, right?
Yeah, I love it. Yeah.
Okay, well, let's hear it.
Nobody making money. The cops is getting rough. Jones got out all the liquor and got out all the gin. That got out all the money and that's a doggone sin now. It ain't nothing doing what you thinking about. It ain't no use to leave it, cause they posted on your route. It's dry right now, but it's gonna get wetter. I'm gonna stay right here until times get better. I say it's dry right now, gonna get wetter. I'm gonna stay right here until the times get better. Thank you.
That's how Jabba Smith sounded in 1929, and you can hear how he sounds now in One More Time, in which he's the featured trumpeter, and he's what, in his 70s now, isn't he?
Yeah.
You were telling us that you've kept things just the way you wanted it in the show, but when you're putting together any kind of show, no matter how true to yourself you're being, there's always kinks you have to iron out. What were some of the things that, with experience and after seeing how things play to the house, you thought ought to be just changed or modified a little bit?
Well, more than play to the house, in rehearsals we had a lot of changes because One More Time is a very loose format. Bertha Williams and a touring company each go out and do a number. Rather than sticking to a script that in the script Bertha sings this and Ma Reed sings that, I really tested to see who would have most fun with which songs, and we swapped around quite a bit so that the characters, for example, on the actor on the album that sing particular songs and not particularly those songs sung by those characters in the show. And each time I'm directing, I think it comes from my Amsterdam experience for 2 years, where it was very heavy experimental theater, sensitivity exercises, Grotowski kind of exercises. We really go through heavy exercises and try to mold into a family type of thing. It's not what I've experienced of the Broadway style. The professional sort of, here's my costume and I have my cordless mic on and out I go. It's really a gel that I try to get out of One More Time. It's a unique experience for the actresses, too.
Were they familiar with the 20s at all and with the music that they have to perform in it?
No, they were brand new to it, and they did a remarkable job in feeling it out.
Tell us a little bit about the musical co-directors for it.
The musical co-directors are both from Sweden, Lars Edgren and Orange Kellen. I met them in New Orleans 10 years ago. They came to study Billy and D.D. Pierce and George Lewis and all the great New Orleans musicians. They were young, optimist Swedish boys at the time, and they not only played the music and got to a point where they were accepted completely by the black musicians, but they also branched off into their own ragtime orchestra where they, this was the jazz thing that they had come to learn, but they also branched off into ragtime and started the New Orleans Ragtime Orchestra. This was way before the Sting and the popularity of Scott Joplin and whoever. And they still have the New Orleans Ragtime Orchestra, which to me is a fantastic group. It's a completely different sound from the New England Conservatory's ragtime sound. But they've learned so much from the black musicians soul-wise, but they've added that cerebral, technical side to all of it that they make great music directors.
You're from New Orleans. Do mm-hmm. you return there much?
Yeah, quite often.
What's the musical atmosphere like there now?
It's pretty dingy. It's a lot of the tourists are really to blame, in a sense. The jazz musicians know an entire world of music, and yet they're always yelled at to play when the Saints go marching in. And even if they go off to play Corrine or whatever, people all during that song will yell, hey, play When the Saints Go Marching In, or St. Louis Blues, or whatever, the typical songs. And it's gotten into, for each hour set that I'll sit through, there's maybe 5 out of the 6 songs that are the same every set. But it's not the lack of creativity on the side of musicians. It's the commercial demand that has really... that's why, for example, Loss and Orange and a lot of the jazz musicians, we have a company in New York and one in New Orleans and this one in Philadelphia. And why I can get very good musicians is because the show does allow a certain freedom away from all of the standards, which after 10 years of playing standards, you want a new experience.
So you think people have become caricatures of themselves because of audience demands?
Yes.
Are there many clubs for musicians to play in?
Yeah, on Bourbon Street there's 8 or 9 clubs, and then there's Preservation Hall, and a few of the hotel have ballrooms. But I'm sort of, you know, I'm very into the music, but the only time the stigma comes out to me, in, I mean, as far as brushing up in my personality, is when I'll go to a restaurant and have what I consider to be a great New Orleans jazz clarinetist in the corner with a banjo player and a guitar player, and he's playing very soft and actually walking around the different tables and will play softly in your ear while you're eating. That's not the music. That's not what the music was about. The music is, like Dr. Rollins said, an intoxicant. It's not dinner music. And it's been, in a lot of cases, perverted and abused. And One More Time to me is a welcome, a fresh air. Also, there was a lack of blues singers in New Orleans. Blanche Thomas died, and that was one of the reasons why I started putting together One More Time. When she died, I had gone to see her quite a bit. She had her cigar and her trench coat, and she'd get up and really knock you down on the ground, you know. There was just not anybody doing it. And when we started, suddenly there was three new blues singers in town, the women I'm talking about. And all of that is just sort of pushing, fighting back against commercialism, putting back the roots and the dignity back into the music.
Well, I want to wish you a lot of luck.
Thank you.
And with One More Time and its continued success, it's been really great to have you here. I want to thank you again for
coming.
Thank
you. Yeah.
I've been speaking with Vernal Benares, who is the person who conceived, directed, and now stars in One More Time, which is now being performed at the Schubert Theater in Philadelphia. And I'd like to close with another selection from the cast recording of One More Time. And we're going to be hearing Papa Di Da Da. And this is a song I didn't hear before coming in contact with the show. Where did you find the song?
I don't know. We went through hundreds of old tapes, and Papa Di Da Da just stuck itself out.
Okay. Well, let's hear it. This is Vernal Benares and the original cast of One More Time.
Dreamy scenes. There's a man, music man, plays and sings, fucking wings. Papa Tree Top Tone. Well, he's long and lean, that's all. Every night, it's a sight you should hear folks call.
Papa Tree Top Tone.
Well, I'm the ladies' man.
Papa Tree Top
Tone. About the sweetest in the land.
Papa Tree Top Tone.
Oh, what clap hand.
He can play the piano grand.
Papa Tree Top Tone. Well, I can sing blues.
Papa Tree Top Tone.
And spread the ladies' news.
Neat and clean, that's what I mean.
He got all the girls in New Orleans. Papa Di Da 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 Da.
He's the hottest man in town.
About the sweetest in the land. Oh, what clam hand.
He can play piano grand.
Well, I can sing blues and spray the ladies blues.
Nice and soft, he never scores. No red hot mama, he cools him up. Papa Di Da 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 Da. He's the hottest man in town.
Papa Di Da Da from the cast recording of One More Time, which is again playing at the Schubert Theater in Philadelphia.